Hi, welcome to another episode of Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast that spotlights some of the city's most interesting and accomplished women. Erica Alston Buck does not sit around waiting for permission. In the wake of the unrest that followed the arrest and death of Freddie Gray last year, she saw a need in West Baltimore's Sandtown Winchester neighborhood, and she filled it using a vacant laundromat. Erica is now famous in that neighborhood for founding the Kids Safe Zone, a center where children and teenagers go to read, eat, study, and play after school and during the summer. Erica, who also serves as Director of Youth Services, Violence Prevention, and Community Outreach at the Penn North Community Resource Center, talked about growing up in Baltimore, the unexpected founding of the Kids Safe Zone, balancing commitments to her work and her family, and exposing the children of West Baltimore to a world outside of what they know. Here's our conversation. So tell me a little bit about yourself.
A little bit about myself. I am the Director of Public Relations and Business Development for Maryland Community Health Initiatives, Inc. And you'll never hear that name unless applying for funding. So I'm the Director of PR for Penn North. That's what we're known as. And I'm also the founding executive director of the Kids Safe Zone. Born and raised in Baltimore, a product of Boton Hill. I wasn't allowed across North Avenue in the same place that I stomp around now. I found my way across North Avenue and got stuck there.
So how did your family end up in Baltimore?
Oh, we've always been here. Probably four generations of us. My great-grandfather from North Carolina got here, and my family's been here ever since. None of us have moved away.
Why is that?
I think there's a lot of that in Baltimore. Baltimore's full of people that are born and raised. You know, that's the term I use. I was born and raised in Baltimore. For the exception of leaving for school, a lot of us come back or never leave. And part of my work is helping kids to leave.
Did you leave for school?
I did not. I went to school here. I went to Mount Royal Elementary Middle School. Back then, you had the opportunity to go to school with the same kids from pre-K to eighth grade. So I have more friends from elementary school than I do from high school or college. I went to high school here, went to college here, everything right here, Baltimore.
That's interesting that you say you help to get kids out of here because so much of the work you do is obviously dedicated to improving our community here. Yeah. Can you tell me more about why you feel that way?
I was brought up in an era where, it makes me sound old, but I was brought up during a time where my parents or their generation taught us to go to school, get an education, get a great paying job, and move away from here. And our culture has taught us that success for African-American middle-class people was outside of the Beltway. So we were taught that. And as gentrification happens and people make conscious decisions to move outside of Baltimore, a lot of us stayed outside of Baltimore and only come to work and get to escape. So it wasn't intentional, my coming back to Baltimore. And it's really all of my life work and what I'm doing right now is very, very surreal. How I ended up where I am, I don't live in Baltimore City without apology. I'm a parent. When you asked me to tell you something about myself, I'm a mom of a 13-year-old girl, a 6-year-old boy in public schools. My older children, who are 25 and 30, had the opportunity to go to private schools. So for African Americans or families who have the opportunity to provide a better education for their children, don't necessarily live in the city. Our school system is crap. And so without apology, I live outside of Baltimore so that my children get a free, good public education. And it's sad that I have to say without apology. It's one of the obstacles that I had to face when I began doing the work that I do in Baltimore City was people saying, she doesn't even live in the city. No, I don't. Because I have children that their education is more important than my zip code.
It's interesting how you were talking about the way that you were raised, mm-hmm. To get an education and get out. Yet, as you said, people do tend to stay here and knock it out and maybe not heed the advice of their parents, although they do get the education. Why do you think that is?
Baltimore is such a eclectic melting pot of everything. There's all these great pockets of the city and they're equally bad pockets of the city. I think when you are born here, there's this sense of loyalty to Baltimore. It's our comfort zone, and that's good or bad. I think about my kids, like 90% of the children that I work with live in Gilmore homes. So are they stuck in a public housing project? if people like us don't come back and show them there's opportunities outside of the 4-block radius that they live in, they don't know that it exists. I went to my elementary and middle schooling was so diverse that we knew that there were opportunities outside of here, but you just wanted, I grew up in Bolton Hill. There's no more comfort than Bolton Hill, than Reservoir Hill. And that sense of community, it's funny, I was in a meeting this morning and someone was talking about Baltimore 35 years ago. Baltimore for Black people 35 years ago is very different from the Baltimore that we are experiencing now. So 35 years ago, 46 years ago, Baltimore was, we were in the house when the streetlights came on. We sat on our front steps. We played. When we went outside, we went outside and played. Kids don't go outside and play. We had friends that lived in the community. And like I said, I went to preschool all the way through middle school with the same group of kids and went to high school with those kids. And a lot of them ventured and went to the same colleges, so they're still here. I don't know what it is that makes Baltimore so homey and comfortable, and maybe there's some complacency. And there's lots of opportunity when you know there's opportunity. So that's very tricky. Do the children in Gilmore Homes know that there's lots of opportunity in Baltimore? It's my responsibility to let them know. So if people aren't, like the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra came into our school, the ballet came into our school, we went to the Morris Mechanic Theater, we went to the Lyric, we read books, we experienced things that showed us a greater world outside of the radius that we lived in, and that made it interesting to go and get it and bring it back. I don't think so many people are going to get it and bring it back. If you're living in a mindset that you have to get an education, get a career, get married and move away, if no one's coming back, who is showing these children that there's a way out? And it shouldn't sound like an escape plan, but in lots of ways it is.
And that seems to be a criticism of a lot of the more successful people who have come from Baltimore. It's kind of like towing this line of what responsibility do they have to the city that they left? Do you feel that?
I do. And I get that. So for me, I think growing up with that mindset of getting yours and getting away, we dropped the baton. There's a whole generation of people that are missing. So right now, we are all existing with this group of youth that have been forgotten, a generation, my generation, that left, didn't come back and say, hey, here's a way. And then my parents and those young adults of the 60s and 70s were such rebels and fought for causes. Now, we're seeing that again now in younger people, not my generation. My generation is working hard, building a legacy, minding their business. My generation is minding their business. And for the celebrities or professional athletes and the people that escaped Baltimore and are minding their business with millions of dollars, it's unfortunate that they don't come back. Some of them give back. So I'm not going to make a general statement that, everyone that made it and got out of Baltimore doesn't, because some of them do. But I think there was a huge opportunity to be more vocal, to be more visible, to be more supportive. And not only when the cameras are shining on us, like now, this is a huge opportunity now when the cameras aren't rolling and people aren't being opportunists or standing on the corner of Pennsylvania and North Avenue with a bullhorn. Like, I'm so over people on the corner of Pennsylvania and North Avenue with a bullhorn. So now when no one's watching, great opportunity to show up. So we can wait for people to show up, or we can show up ourselves. And I just chose to stop complaining about other people not doing and do something.
When you were young, what did you want to be when you grew up, and what path did you see your life taking?
I wanted to be Oprah. And this is 2 days in a row that I've answered that question.
Really? And Oprah had a stint in Baltimore also. So
yes. And I, again, back to community and living in an era where, Oprah was like Eyewitness News. She was, out and about, and we saw her. She was a real person.
So you saw her when she was like on WJZ? Yes.
Yeah. I, growing up in Reservoir Hill, our reprieve, our safe place was the Enoch Pratt Free Library that was up on the hill in Reservoir Hill. We had to climb up a hill to get to this library. It felt like a castle, but all of us, we would go to the library. And I had, and oh my gosh, this is going to sound so corny, but at 8 years old, I tested with a genius IQ. and my test scores were in somebody's percentile, and I was like some big deal in elementary school, and Oprah came to interview me at the library.
Oh my gosh, yes. That's amazing.
Oprah came to interview me at the library, and this is how traumatized I am from that experience. At 46 years old, some almost 40 years later, I can remember how bad I screwed up on that interview. And I was such a kid. The last line of that book that she, now I'm the world's best reader. Like, you have to go meet Erica Alston. She's this prodigy. She's 8 years old, genius IQ. And I read the last line as someone to claim her down. It was calm. How does the best reader say claim in the world?
No.
Yes.
It happens.
It happens.
Especially to an 8-year-old. I think that's pretty forgivable.
Yeah, with Oprah with a microphone in your face. So in that moment, I thought I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a reporter. I was going to be on TV. I was going to be a newscaster. And there's no guarantee that you'll be on TV or radio, Erica. And that's what your parents say when you're, going to college. But there'll always be sick people. So you go for healthcare administration, and you never work in healthcare, and you always work in TV and radio. And so it was the one thing that I could always say, I told you so, until March of 2015, where healthcare administration became the director of business development for a substance abuse treatment center. Some 20-some professional years later, it's not about public relations or marketing or TV. But yeah, I wanted to be Oprah. Didn't make it, but... and I'm still vying for her to come and see the work that we're doing.
And she gave Devin Allen the stamp of approval, right? And
absolutely.
He does work at the Kids Safe Zone.
Yeah, so that's as close as I've gotten.
Yeah, that's
pretty close.
I mean, you are 1 degree of separation from Oprah. You have been interviewed by the Queen, so yeah. I think that's pretty good. So how did you start your work at Penn North?
I still wake up every morning and hear God's belly aching laugh at me. I was working for a radio station doing what I thought I wanted to do forever. And on a Friday at 4:45, I lost my job. And I had been volunteering at Penn North with girls, young women in recovery, 18 to 26 years old. I'd created the Be Extraordinary Project, and it was a small support group for women in recovery that were 18 to 26. I'd meet with them every Monday at 6 o'clock, and Penn North would give me a $50 stipend so I could buy like donuts and juice and little materials that we would use for these projects that I would do with these girls. So I've been doing that for maybe about 90 days, because when I'm in recovery, and I entered recovery at 26 years old, and I could remember going to Penn North at 26 years old and thinking, I'm not like these old people. And, it's not a secret that, Baltimore got a heroin problem. So when you go to 12-step meetings and you go to treatment or you're in recovery environments, most people are talking about shooting heroin and living in abandoned houses. And I thought at 26, whoa, I didn't do any of that. And people in recovery encourage you to, stay clean, get clean, get clean, stay clean. But I needed the stay clean and what? Especially at 26 years old. Okay, I'm clean now. Now what? And so there's this huge influx of these young people in recovery. 18 to 26 prescription drugs, mollies, marijuana, new drugs, new addicts, a new age group. And so I was there volunteering with those girls, just giving them the and what. Like, okay, you're clean now. So one wanted to go into the Navy. Okay, so it was about having a goal and then taking the steps to meet the goal and helping them identify the steps and the path to reach their goal. Things that I just wish I had at that age. And so one wanted to go to Navy, one wanted to go to UB. Yay, Kiara's registered at UB right now. So helping them do that. So on the day that I lost my job, I got home like a deer in headlights, and my fiance at the time, my husband now, says, well, you know what you need to do? I was like, find a job now. And he goes, no, you need to dedicate 100% of your time to those young women at Penn North. And I was like, you do know that pays $50 a week, and I spend that on donuts. and he says, you've got to do it. So I was hanging out at Penn North. I actually met with the executive director of Penn North just to ask him to increase the amount of times I could meet with the girls. I wanted to go from one day a week to three times a week. And in that meeting with him, he explained to me like all the stuff that he wanted to do in the community and all the things that he had dreamed of being able to do. Like when I talked about the young women and goals, he was like, I always wanted to implement things like that and like build up the community and do something with the vacant houses and do things for ex-offenders. And he wanted to do so much more. And I was like, oh, well, you need to meet these people or you need to meet with this person. And he's like, well, how do you know all this? And I was like, oh, well, I've been in PR for 20 years in Baltimore. So I pretty much know everyone. And I left that meeting as the director of public relations. I went to get my group three times a week, and I left that meeting, the director of public relations and business development, and I started in March of 2015. And I was hired to be the director of PR for a little drug treatment center that had been there for 20 years, and the only people that knew about it were the people that needed the services. So there's no signage at Penn North. There's no, you know, vacancy lights flashing, but 200 people in recovery live there. In the former, the original Frederick Douglass High School. So I was hired to be the director of PR in March, and then 30 days later, Freddie Gray happened. And I just happened to be the director of PR for an organization footsteps away from Gilmore Homes Projects. So Freddie Gray was someone who walked down the street. It wasn't someone I saw on TV. And while the uprising was happening on national television, it was happening outside of our door. So that police car that was on fire was right there. When that police car was set on fire, our cell phones were ringing from family members asking if we were okay because they were watching it on TV and we were at work. So I go from being the director of public relations to being a person that hears that there's very little for children to do in that community. Sandtown is 72 city blocks. It's a huge footprint. And there were no organized sports. There was no Boys and Girls Club, no Sandtown Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts, a after-school program. Very little extracurricular activities for children, a recreation center with no children in it. And my truth is, when I was hearing people in the community say that, because our community center turned into like Media Central, like MSNBC and all those national broadcasters were using our facility to sleep and have water and charge their laptops and upload their stories. And they were dragging people into our center, interviewing anyone. During the uprising, if you walked down the street and you looked like you knew Freddie Gray or you knew of what was happening in the Gilmore Homes Project, you were snatched into our building and someone interviewed you. So I got to continuously hear the people being interviewed saying, well, our children need something to do. And my truth is, I would hear that and say, well, someone should really do something about that. Oh, these kids don't have anything to do. It's no wonder they were throwing rocks at the cops. There's nothing for them to do. And I thought to myself, that's very unfortunate. Someone should do something. And then I realized, like, well, no one's doing anything. And I went to my executive director and I said, why can't we create something for the children? I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea that some 18 months later, we'd be the kids safe zone, or I'd be that kids safe zone lady. Like, I never aspired to work with children. This was not some lifelong goal. It wasn't some lifelong passion. It's really, really surreal to me that I went to my executive director, said, why can't we be it for the children? He gave me the key to a vacant laundromat, and we became it for the children.
It must be really hard to describe, but that just sounds so surreal to me. Yeah. I mean, can you tell me about what you remember from the unrest the most and what it was like when all of that first broke?
Yep, we were actually hosting Freddie Gray's repast. We were hosting the celebration after his funeral for his family and close friends. The Penn North Community Resource Center acts as that to everyone in that community. We host baby showers and birthday parties and anything. There's been weddings and receptions at our community center. So we were hosting the repast, and the funeral was over. Family was coming. They were laughing and celebrating. And maybe 20 minutes in, family members started running outside and coming back saying, we're on lockdown. And I thought, what? Why are we on lockdown? And who are you, Mr. Bandana, to be locking us down? So we have family members yelling, we're on lockdown and nobody can leave this building and no one can come in. Like, okay. They said, they're setting the CVS on fire. It was like mass mayhem. And our phones were ringing and our family members were calling, and we could leave, but we wouldn't leave. Like, why would we leave the community that way? Our community center is, like, always open. When everything else was closed, we were open. When the windows were being bust out of the library and CVS had been burned down and caucuses of burned police cars, people just in the street. Billy Graham. That's, like, one of my most visible, like, I thought maybe hallucination, but no, it's real. That's a big Billy Graham RV.
Like, yeah.
There were like 5,000 Subway sandwiches. diapers being delivered, a keg, like barrels of fruit salad, like in an uprising during an unrest, deliver fruit salad. No, but they ate it. Formula, clothing, bottles of water from all over the place. And what was happening was things were being delivered to the corner of Pennsylvania and North Avenue. And because of who we've been to the community for so long, they would just say, oh, take it around to the resource center. Take it to Penn North. And the vacant laundromat that turned into the Kids Safe Zone was actually a space that was donated to us to house the donations that were coming in. So our landlord said, hey, you guys can like borrow this space to keep all that junk that's coming in. And that's what that space was originally for. So in that, if we felt like a third world country, there was an equal amount of people singing and dancing and celebrating as there were people praying and crying and mourning. People you've never seen before that live here forever showed up. And I rolled my eyes because what happened on April 27th was the result of decades of a community, a culture, a people being ignored, not having a voice, and finding it in the snap of a finger. They finally found out how to be seen and heard without condoning any violence or any property destruction. That was, you can see me, you can hear me, help me. And it worked. Regardless of how much damage, how much money it cost in overtime, how much turmoil, chaos, confusion, noise, chatter, regardless of how much of that was happening, they were heard and got some results. Money is coming into Sandtown. And money's come into Sandtown before. They built about 70 pretty houses, and the rest of the 72 blocks fell apart. The open-air drug markets in that community. You can buy any prescription drug you want on the corner of Pennsylvania and North Avenue. It's a metro stop. You can buy any prescription drug you want in the middle of the day as if it's legal. There'll be a group of people selling drugs, and then there'll be a group of police officers across the street. I've never seen anything like it. And during the uprising, it didn't stop. So there was celebration. There was crying, praying, mourning. There was drug selling. Crime did not go down. And then it got quiet. And people were saying that the police weren't policing. The police were always visible. The police were always visible. That is one, my most disturbing memory is driving by Matthew Henson High School, and there had to be 300 soldiers in that parking lot. The National Guard, in the middle of the night, leaving work at 9, 10 o'clock at night and seeing 300 soldiers blocks away from your workplace. I remember driving to work one day during the unrest, and on my way, I had to stop for a family of deer that were crossing the street in my neighborhood. And, you know, that's a pretty cool sight. Okay, come on, get your baby. They're all crossing the street. And to just drive 10 more minutes and have to tell the National Guard to move so I can get through to get to work. So you go from a deer crossing to a National Guard crossing in 10 minutes. So much needs to be done, and we're only scratching the surface. I think we keep doing enough to shut them up. And gratefully, the residents of Sandtown aren't being shut up anymore. So just because the cameras aren't rolling anymore, it doesn't mean the work's not being done. Like Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle coming in and creating the Tubman House. I think we set a precedent with take over a vacant spot and do something with it. All these vacant houses, don't wait for coding and permits. Like, do it. What's the worst thing that's going to happen? If you create a safe space for children or vulnerable adults, because that's what lives in Sandtown, the most vulnerable population of adults. Children are living in public housing where their moms are trading sex for hot water and heat. Why are we living in those conditions? And thank God for like Communities United who give those women a voice. So even though the baton had been dropped with my generation, I think the uprising lent a way for us to pick it back up. It showed us that we can't move away and live our life and mind our business because our youth and young adults are our business. It's no longer, I am my brother's keeper, I am my brother. I think a sense of unity sprung from it, and another sense of divide. There is still so much division in the 21217 zip code. That zip code is Bowdoin Hill and Sandtown. That zip code is Reservoir Hill and Penn North. That zip code is Hamden You know, that zone is hemmed in. Look at the difference between the corner of Pennsylvania North Avenue and, you know, 36th Street. It's systemic, it's designed, and it should be no longer tolerated.
I'm curious, especially being at the epicenter like that. I mean, many people were criticizing the national media, mm-hmm. like CNN, coming in for their coverage of the unrest. You were seeing what was really happening mm-hmm. being there, and you're also, like, housing these reporters and stuff who are coming in to charge their computers. What was your take on the coverage of it, and how do you think Baltimore was perceived by people outside of the city?
In another life, I worked for the organization responsible for promoting Baltimore as a place to live, work, and play. So this is very ironic for me. It was my job to promote Baltimore as a place to live, work, and play. And so there are two very different Baltimores. That is our reality. And when we lie and say that it's not, we are lying. There are two very different Baltimores. Even driving, I drove from the Kids Safe Zone here through Mount Vernon and sitting at the light, you know, watching the Mount Vernon marketplace and thinking how very different just the air is. It's very different to see the people sitting in Mount Vernon Square. That's not happening in Sandtown. So you tear down a whole block of vacant houses and say you're going to create green space for us. Okay, the vacant houses have been torn down. I've not seen the green space and pretty trees and parks. So what has always happened for Baltimore is the corner, is homicide, is the wire, and what Baltimore wants to promote as this national convention city. And okay, I understand tourism. I understand hospitality. I understand the dollars that the city and state get as a result of people wanting to travel here. So continue to bring them here and don't let them see above North Avenue, right? Continue to do the tours of below. Like, my kids have never been to, my Kids Safe Zone children have never been to Harbor East, right? So taking a group of kids down to Harbor East and having them believe that they've gone out of town. They think they've gone out of town. Where are we? That's heartbreaking. That's heartbreaking to take inner city children blocks away and have them ask, where are we? Because they think they're somewhere else. So, yep, we house the media. Did I encourage any negative stories to be told? No, I've been very vocal about opportunists. I don't like people coming into my hood and taking the opportunity to look like you are doing something for people that you are not. No, so that's not happening. The media came in and they showed what was happening from their, that's their job. What I could do is when they want to snatch any old person and interview them, say, no, this person's lived in this community for 20 years. You may want to talk to them. Or have relationships with other community leaders, have meetings and do things collectively. Because when I say there's a divide, there's even a divide in community leaders and organizations. Why is there Drude Heights, Penn North, Sandtown, and Upton? You know, within four blocks, the same kids go to the same services, but it's so divided by a name and the fear that I'll be funded and you won't, or it's fighting over scraps versus fighting over a purpose and a passion to really have something change in the lives of these people, not just children, but the seniors that live there. So yeah, the media was there. The media did their job. The media showed that there is a Baltimore that exists at the corner of Pennsylvania North Avenue that is very different from the Baltimore that exists in Harbor East.
Yeah, and a lot of people have definitely seem blind to that.
Yeah.
Like if you look on the Canton Neighbors Facebook page, for example.
Right, exactly. What is that? Oh, tonight we're having a movie. Come try to sit out on the corner of Pennsylvania North Avenue and watch a movie. It's not going to happen.
And it's not beneficial to act like
we don't exist.
Certain parts of Baltimore don't exist, the good or the bad, I think.
Right, because that, back to your first question, that's what makes Baltimore. There are so many pockets of greatness in the city that you can do a cartwheel and end up in a crack house. Like you could be in this hoity-toity, wonderful neighborhood, do one cartwheel, and it's like, oh, they're selling heroin on this corner. But that doesn't mean that Sandtown, those children don't know that that's not great. They don't know. Should they know that that's not great? Absolutely. Some sense of pride is gone. Like, I had to scrub those marble steps. I don't know the last time I saw somebody scrub their steps. Like, that was a chore. If you were under 18 years old, you had Ajax, a scrub brush in a bucket, and you were scrubbing the steps.
Yeah, that's an old Baltimore tradition, yeah. Isn't it?
And then yeah. The steps are still there, but we're not scrubbing them. And those steps are now connected to so many vacant. Like, the vacancy value should really speak to the devaluation of the children and the communities that don't get the support. That's what it is, that don't get the support. And a part of that, what is systemic is, in my neighborhood, this is a true story, there was a pothole on Monday. I hit a pothole on a Monday. Wednesday, the pothole was filled. And then you drive across North Avenue, and you nearly lose your car because you can fall into a car-sized pothole. Like, what is happening that no one sees or cares that North Avenue, you cannot drive across North Avenue without damaging your car? Those streets, and then there's pretty bike routes. I saw those yesterday driving down St. Paul. They're cool. Streets are nicely paved, nice little bike routes. Cars have learned to park a different way. But in the hood, we can't. We've got rows and rows of vacant houses. Not fair.
I read a quote of yours somewhere. It may have been on your Facebook. I'm sorry to be creepy. I got to do my research. But you said, "My transparency empowers others in recovery. I amplify the voice of children." I was hoping you could tell me more about that statement. I thought it was really nice.
My transparency in terms of recovery. I think I am so vocal now. Because I haven't always been. I did not wear this badge of honor that, hey, I'm in recovery. I used to use drugs because of the stigma associated with drug addiction and recovery. So what happens is intelligent, articulate, professional people are hiding. They are hiding the fact that they're in recovery, that they are recovering from alcoholism. So they're the folks that are, you know, no, just give me a cranberry and ginger ale, but not, you know, it's never been something to be proud of for me. You tell someone you're a recovering addict and they start to clutch their purse. You know, Erica's the only one here. Oh no. Someone else should be there. You know, Erica shouldn't be the last one in the building. So for 19 years, I hid the fact that I was a person in recovery. So what my transparency does and has, I get phone calls, I get inbox messages, I get emails from people thanking me that because I am open and honest and transparent about being in recovery, they were able to do the same thing. And it's such a freedom. There is such a freedom involved in being able to be your true, authentic self, because what it does, it empowers other people. So when people see me, they can, even down to like the cameramen that come out to do a story when the news comes to interview me, cameramen have been able to come from behind the camera and go, hey, I saw something about you. I've got 17 years. How cool is that? That there's at least one person that you can say that you haven't been on drugs for 17 years and you got a really cool job as the cameraman for a TV station. And then amplifying the voice of the children. Again, very surreal. I did not know that's what I was doing. I did not know until I started doing it that no one was speaking up for those babies. When on the first day that we opened the Kids Safe Zone, there were 40 children on the first day, right? We transformed a vacant laundromat, 1,000 square feet of nothing, into this place where every child wanted to hang out. So on the first day, there were 40, and then the second day, there were 65, and then there were 80, and then school let out, and there were 106 children in this space. I knew immediately, whoa, 100 kids didn't have somewhere to go. And it didn't take long to realize that they needed more than just a place to hang out. That community is so traumatized and don't realize that they're living in trauma. There's so much grief and so much loss that they don't know what that feeling is. So when a child is acting out or throwing a book or, you know, calling Miss Erica some bad name every day, it's easier to do that than to say, I need help. I'm afraid at home. This is where I feel safe. I don't have food at home. There's no electricity. It's cold. Like, they didn't have anyone to say those things to that they trusted. So what the uprising did and what the Kids Safe Zone did was allow us to see for decades so many people have come in and made promises. So many people that don't look like them have come in and made promises, left, and the promises never get fulfilled. So I set out on June 1st, the first day that we opened our doors, to never be one of those people. Like, I'm never going to be one of those old people that says that they're going to be there and not be there. I've got a 10-year-old at the Kids Safe Zone right now waiting with an overnight bag to spend the weekend at my house. They fight over who's going to come to my house. That's what parental consent. Mom comes in. My daughter keeps asking me, can she come spend the night at your house? Well, I don't know why your daughter's asking that because I didn't ask your daughter. We didn't have this conversation. And then these kids look up at me and say, please, Miss Erica. And the first time I took the kids home, I took like 10 kids home for a weekend. And I had a little boy come into my house and look around like he was in a museum. It was really gut-wrenching to watch him look at my, you know, mediocre little home as if he was in some palace. And then he sat down and he looked at me and he says, you and Mr. Eddie don't beat them, do you? I said, what? And he was asking about our children. He says, do your kids get beatings? I was like, oh, no. And he says, I didn't think so. And that breaks my heart right now, right? To walk into someone's home and feel safe and know that I'm not going to hurt you. And for me to not be the person that wanted this to be their life's work. It's, again, I hear him laughing. Ha, 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 ha. You wanted to be Oprah. Now you're a Kids Safe Zone lady. And there's nothing else in this world that I would want to be.
Have you always been a leader?
Did I ever follow the rules? No. I've got a tattoo of a panther on my right arm, the same tattoo that Ray Lewis has. And my mom told me that I was going to regret getting that tattoo. And I just thought that she didn't want me to be cool. And I still regret that tattoo because Ray Lewis's tattoo looks like a huge panther. Mine looks like a grasshopper. And so, yes, I think that's back to that testing in the eighth grade. Like, I always read, even though, and I didn't live in Bolton Hill. Let me say this. I didn't live in Bolton Hill and Reservoir Hill and these hoity-toity little communities because my parents did so well. I was raised by a single mother. My mom worked very hard. My mom went without shoes. I remember my mom walking me and my brother to school without shoes so we could have shoes. My mom was smart enough to take her federally funded, subsidized housing Section 8 certificate and put us in neighborhoods that had good schools. My mom was smart enough to know that if we lived in Bolton Hill, we would get a better education by going to that school. My mom was also smart enough to know that when you live in Bolton Hill, people that live in Bolton Hill throw out really cool things. So our house was always like really cool from things that my mom found in the neighborhood. So it's back to experiences. And that's what I'm able to give those children. I'm able to say to them, well, you don't have to be rich. You know, you just got to read a book. Read. If you want to escape your madness, you can read a book and go wherever you want. So the first rule that I implemented at the Kids Safe Zone was every child had to read for 15 minutes before you could play the video games. And it works. And as we become more official, and I don't know if I like that or not, it was a different walk. And, you know, I need to call, like, Adam and Davon from Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. I remember them posting something about funding and grants and what that meant. And how we need to fund ourselves. Because as helpful as the foundations want to be, there are so many regulations. There are so many T's to cross and I's to dot. There's so much reporting. And what a foundation believes is an outcome may not necessarily be the outcomes that you... Like my outcome every day is to keep a child alive. My outcome every day is to have a child be able to give an answer when you ask him, what do you want to be when you grow up? I didn't know until I started doing this work that children didn't have an answer to that anymore. So an outcome for me is a 16-year-old black boy who lives in Gilmore Homes Projects who one day said, Miss Erica, stop asking me what I want to be when I grow up. I'm trying to make it through the day. Whoa, it's a reality check. He's trying to make it through the day. There's no guarantee that he's going to grow up. So how dare you keep asking him what he wants to be when he grows up, when what he wants to be when he grows up is alive. For that answer from him to change to, he wants to be an OBGYN. So we get a little brown boy from Gilmore Homes Project who couldn't see past today, who now wants to be an OBGYN. And I'm so vocal on my Facebook page because people want to help. I'm not from some place that I believe that people don't want to help us. People want to help, and because they want to help, I post everything, and the help shows up. So I posted on my Facebook page, I've got a 16-year-old black boy who lives in Gilmore Homes Projects who wants to be a doctor. It is our responsibility to make sure he becomes a doctor. And I get an email with 20 people copied on it in the University of Maryland Medical System, and doctors and residents that are black, that look like him, that want to mentor him. The labor and delivery unit organizing a tour for him. People, how awesome is that? That I make a Facebook post that it's our responsibility to make sure that this little boy becomes a doctor, and doctors respond? So it's a reality for him now. The same kid who thought that he was out of town at Harbor East can now dream of being a doctor.
Beyond doing things like that on social media, how do you do that in the kids' safe zone in a practical sense? Like, what kind of mentorship are you giving these kids?
It was very important for me immediately for people that looked like them who didn't live the way that they lived anymore to come in. I started a program when we first started called She Tours, and that was my female version of mentors. So She Tours were African-American, professional, educated women who came to mentor the girls at the Kids Safe Zone. And in our very first meeting, a very good friend of mine who owns her own brokerage talked about real estate. And in that meeting, those children didn't know that selling a house was a job, right? They don't know that you can sell a house and make a living. The conversation about, like, even after she left, about real estate agents and brokerages, you mean I can sell you? Yes. How do you think? Because they live in housing projects. They don't see people buying a house. So it is about bringing new experiences to these children. It is about the president of Totally Cool Ice Cream coming in and telling these children that he started off as an ice cream scooper at 14 years old with some ice cream shop, and now he's got one of the largest ice cream cake companies in the world, and for him to bring ice cream and all the toppings for the kids to make their own sundaes, because they need to aspire to be more than basketball players, football players, and rap stars. I also steer clear of sending the message to little brown children that the epitome of success is owning your own business. Like, somewhere someone taught little black kids that you got to own your own business to be successful. That's not a truth. Like, and my story to them is, well, what if I really owned our own business? Who's going to wait on us at the restaurant? Who's going to drive the bus? Who's going to pick up the trash? And they're like, oh, well, can I own the trash truck company? Sure, but you probably have to learn how to drive a trash truck first. It's when you live in public housing and most of the people around you didn't graduate from high school or leave the house every day to go to work. Who's showing you that you are supposed to graduate from high school, go to college, and get a career? So that is what the Kids Safe Zone is about. It's not just about creating a place for kids to hang out, but it's about creating a place for kids to hang out where they're safe, but they're also exposed to new experiences. If I don't do anything else than plant a seed that your world is bigger than the 4-block radius that you live in, that you can be whatever you want to be, and that's not a cliche, that you can aspire to be more than a rap star. If you want to rap, sure. Let's be a rapping attorney. So every other Tuesday, a group of lawyers comes in and meets with my kids from 6 to 8 so they can learn legal jargon and legal pathways to professions. The volunteers that come through, because we're volunteer run. We have 6 staff members, but every day volunteers come to help us. And I don't have preferences over what volunteers look like or what they do. My volunteers need to be safe. That means background check. And they need to be available. Safe, available, and consistent. Because, again, the Kids Safe Zone is about relationships.
What has surprised you most about this work?
What has surprised me most is the kids call me, I'm hood famous. What is most surprising is wherever we go, like, My kids and my husband are so over it. Yes, that's her. If someone's like staring and pointing from across the room, my husband's like, yeah, it's her. And people want to, you know, like, talk to me and tell me about their dreams of opening organizations. I met a woman today, and she wanted to open a LGBT transitional house for gay women leaving prison and reentering society. How cool is that? So for her to be sitting next to me at the doctor's office telling me what she wants to do. And I'm like, oh my God, you can so do that. And I work with this population of people, like, we could so work together. And she says, well, what do you do? And I say what I do, and I throw Kids Safe Zone in. And she goes, oh my God, you're the lady with the big hair. I didn't recognize you because your hair wasn't big. She says, but you sound familiar. So it's that. It's that and being called for anything youth and violence related. My husband has this running joke with me, like a reporter will call me, hey, Erica, crime statistics are up with young people. We wanted to come by and talk to you about, you know, what you think about it. So my husband always, when I hang up the phone, he goes, who was that? And I'll name a TV station. He goes, oh, yeah, they called me first, but I was busy, so I told them to call you. So it's that. It's coming from a place where you didn't know a thing. Right. I'm only using my own personal life experiences and sharing with these children what I needed for myself and being this authority. Yeah. Like I told you this morning, meeting with these people from Northern Ireland. That's what's surreal. It's waking up every day, getting ready for work because I want to go to work. And I had an experience over the summer where I stood on the steps of the kids' safe zone and the kids were outside playing. And across the street from us is a basketball court, a playground, and a big open field. And I stood on the steps and I looked across the street, and the playground was full of kids playing and laughing. The basketball court was full of kids playing basketball, and the field was full of children playing the biggest game of musical chairs I'd ever seen in my life. And I stood back and said, you did that. That's like unbelievable. I was like, whoa. Like the vacant laundromat is now an 8,000 square foot facility that's bright and vibrant. It's a real program. It's not just a place where kids just hang out. Like, it's the only place that you can come every day at 6 o'clock and 40 to 100 kids are in downward dog doing yoga. Like, how cool is that? I still get moved to tears, like standing in that room, hearing those kids call out poses or watching them in meditation. These children have at least 1 hour out of their day that there are no problems, that they can close their eyes and escape whatever madness they're living in and fall asleep. Meditation is my favorite part of the day. It's like at 6 o'clock, they're all in yoga, and like by 6:45, they're laying down and it's meditation, but they all fall asleep.
They should do that in preschool instead of nap time. Yes. I could never fall asleep.
Yes, they really should.
Yoga's really the way. Should.
It's the way.
So do you still have Oprah ambitions?
My only ambition for Oprah is to have her come and see us. No, the question I'm asked the most is, where do you see yourself in 5 years or 10 years or down the road? And I don't have an answer for that. I know it will involve the kids' safe zone. I know that I am working in a position that I will retire from. I know that I am doing work that I will retire from, and someone, one of my children will be, it's my day to go get mom and take her down to the kids' safe zone so I can hang out there. My hope is that I've created a model that says you don't have to wait for the perfect space or the perfect grant or the perfect check writer to create what's needed in your community. I took a vacant space and I went to the community at large, which is my Facebook page, 12,000 people. And I said, I need paint and games and TVs, computers. I need video games. I need arts and crafts supplies and food and snacks and juices. Juice boxes and waters, and people showed up with that stuff. Like every single day, there was some soccer mom in a minivan in the hood on my parking lot going, I got tagged to a Facebook post by somebody named Erica and I got 5,000 Pop-Tarts. Like, where does that happen? P.F. Chang's called and donated their bar stools, and those are the stools that the kids sit in to play their video games. The Holiday Inn Inner Harbor donated us their soft furniture, and that's how we created our reading nook. Most recently, a private preschool in Howard County closed its doors after 60 years and gave us everything. Like, we've got the coolest little space, and we finally got funded. You know, the city finally saw us as a program that needed some work, that needed some help, and stepped in to help us. So we got $40,000 from the city over the summer, and we just recently awarded $75,000 to get us through the fall. And with that, my fear, and this is about my future, my fear is that the Kids Safe Zone will turn into something that it wasn't intended to be. And I just had an opportunity to sit back this morning and see my teenagers falling off because it's not as fun as it used to be. And that's not an option for me. So I'm changing my schedule for my 12 to 17-year-olds, and 4 to 6 o'clock will be open play for them, where now it's 2 to 3:30 is homework and homework assistance, 3:30 to 4 is open play, 4 to 5 is peer-led support group chat, and 5 o'clock is dinner, and they're not there. I would rather have an environment that is full of children than a bunch of structure that's empty. So my 5 to 8 year olds, they roll through the schedule. They're fine. But the 12 to 17 year olds are so vulnerable, so at risk. It's more attractive to be outside on a corner with your friends, even knowing that the likelihood of you being shot by a stray bullet is way up there. It's still culturally relevant to stand on the corner. It's still sociably acceptable to, you know, not be in some structured environment. So I need to go back to my roots. And thankfully for me, it's not too far, you know, removed, that I'm not just creating a safe place that provides some academic support and some an outlet for children to express themselves, but it needs to be a place where children want to be. Because if children aren't there, no funding is needed. I don't need your money if my kids aren't coming. And if my kids aren't coming based on all the requirements that you have for me to operate, I'll turn down a check. So my hope is, like with the leaders like Munir Bahar and what he's doing in East Baltimore with buying 4 vacant buildings and converting them to the Core Health Institute, where there'll be a kids safe zone component attached to it. So that's a pseudo kids safe zone East. There needs to be one in South. Why doesn't Park Heights have a kids safe zone? Why doesn't Cherry Hill have a kids safe zone? So that is businesses. That's property owners. Of the vacant laundromat was a donation from Capital T, who our landlords. They donated that space. So there are some business owners in Baltimore that have a storefront. They have a space that's usable, but there's not a tenant in there. So why can't you open the doors for kids to have a place to go? There's a population of young people that need the most attention right now. Those are like 16 to 26-year-olds that are falling through the system. They need something. So that's where I'll be. I'll be leading a charge that says, you don't have to wait for the perfect space. Just do it. Let me help you. I'm not going to do it for you. I'm very, very busy. So all the phone calls and emails that I get, oh, I want to start a kids safe zone. I want to start something like you did. Can you come and walk me through? No, I can't walk you through the entire process. And my executive director jokingly says that I make it look easy on Facebook. And I do. I make it look easier than it is. There's a lot of sleepless nights. There's a lot of sacrifice. There's a lot of sacrifice. There's so many times that you could be doing other things, but because you have this mission and this passion, this purpose, there's nothing else that you would rather do than do this, and then you find balance. So no, we're not open 7 days a week anymore. I owe it to my husband and my family to be active and engaged in my personal life, and so does my staff. We're not open 12 hours a day anymore. When school started, we went from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. When the summer comes, we are still 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. because I now understand the kids go to school to eat. Kids go to school to have heat and air conditioning. Kids go to school to be seen and heard. And sometimes they don't have that at home. So when school is closed, I am open. So my work continues. In some capacity, I'll always be doing this. But nope, don't want to be Oprah.
Well, Erica, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Female Trouble. You can subscribe on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you liked what you heard, it would really help us out to give us a rating on iTunes. We are on Twitter at FMLTrouble, and you can also find us at baltimoresun.com/FemaleTrouble. Our theme song, Dope Girls, is by Shifty and features TT the Artist. Thanks again, and see you next week. Dope Girls!